or enforcing the court order. In other words, we would now have to rely solely on them to keep us safe and alive. I sat paralyzed on the living room couch, reading the article aloud once more as Grandma was organizing the family to prepare for our traditional Thanksgiving celebration. I consoled myself with the fact that there was no specific departure date for the 101st. Maybe they meant after the first of the year. I would go on hoping that article was mistaken. Surely they couldn't really be leaving. "Put that paper down, girl. It's time." We had begun our holiday ritual. Grandma was desperately trying to wrestle Conrad's old train set away from him to give to the poor. "Thanksgiving, son. That's time to count our blessings. We've got to give deep this year, because those benevolent white people who gave to our folks in years past are holding out on us to make us give up the integration." White charity groups were breaking traditions by taking away their Thanksgiving gifts and threatening to take away Christmas as well. To make matters more difficult, they were taking away as many jobs from my people as they could and cutting credit at the local stores. It was our tradition each year to sort through our toys and clothing at Thanksgiving and give away all the things we didn't need or use, as well as two things dear to us that we would especially like to keep. "Conrad, have you got that train boxed yet?"
"Not yet, Grandma."
"When, Conrad?" Mother said, as she dried the dinner dishes and handed them to me to put away. She and Grandma had been trying all day to get Conrad to see things their way.
"Melba's giving away her favorite blouse," Grandma said, "and she's donating her favorite cord skirt and a pair of shoes."
She glanced at Conrad to see whether or not her prodding was affecting his stingy attitude.
"Melba likes suffering and doing without. That's why she goes to Central. But why do I have to?"
"Where did you get a notion like that about your sister?"
"Clark said that's what his folks say, because sis stays in that white school being mistreated every day."
Her staying there means she has made a promise that she intends to keep, because she told God she would, and she doesn't want to let herself and God down. Mother Lois said, walking over to look Conrad in the eye.
"So you must explain that to Clark the next time he inquires about your sister's motives."
"Yes, ma'am."
"But I'm not giving up the train. It's mine."
"Let's get down to basics, boy. If you don't ante up, you won't get any Thanksgiving dinner, and nobody will play Monopoly with you for a full week." Conrad's eyes got large and his forehead wrinkled as he let go of the train's engine, and Grandma placed it in the gift box with our other contributions. U.S. officials drop plans to prosecute agitators at school. Won't press action against mob leaders. Arkansas Gazette, Thursday, November 21st, 1957. Based on an assurance by local authorities that they would maintain order, the federal government announced it would back off and not even prosecute segregationist mob leaders. The segregationist leaders were celebrating their victories, and the students at school were letting us know about their triumph. At the same time, Governor Faubus was saying in print and on the air that the withdrawal of federal troops is distasteful because the Arkansas Guard will be left with the distasteful task of enforcing the integration. He said he would not take any state police forces or National Guardsmen to transport anybody to school or guard them while they were there. For Arkansas Guardsmen to do what the federal government ordered would be unfair because they didn't enlist to enforce integration, but to defend their country in a time of need. At school that day, Minnie Jean and I talked about how frightened we were because, even though the harassment was getting worse, we were seeing fewer and fewer uniformed guards of any description. There were always rumors about FBI men being all over the place. Sure enough,
we would occasionally see men who fit our fantasies of what FBI men should look like, but they never stopped to help us. To add to our distress, on that same day, two state courts demanded that the NAACP's records be made public, and six men who were arrested for rioting during our first days at Central High School were cleared of all charges. On November 23rd, an article described how Judge Harry Robinson suspended fines of two men found guilty of rioting. And even as our problems with segregationists multiplied, yet again, Minnie Jean focused on her audition for the Glee Club and Christmas show. She had worked herself up into a real diva. Time and time again, Thelma and I had tried to talk her out of participating, but she wouldn't listen. Moments before the tryouts got underway, I stood in the doorway of the auditorium, nervously wringing my hands as Minnie Jean tried to register. Mrs. Huckabee wore a pleasant smile as she explained to Minnie Jean that the day to register for the tryouts had long since passed and they couldn't violate the rules for her. We knew at once that she had been tricked. Had school officials been sincere about offering Minnie Jean the opportunity, they would have been clear about the terms for participating. Blinking back tears, Minnie Jean turned to us, then walked away. Thelma and I trailed behind, trying our best to console her. Teachers, students say Central High seethes with undercurrents. Arkansas Gazette, Sunday, November 24th, 1957. Six reporters had been dispatched to talk to anyone connected with the school. What they found was what we already knew. As the reporter said, it was a time of tension and testing. There was widespread talk of gangs dedicated to making trouble for us when the troops left. Those interviewed said they already made as much trouble for us as they could. However, we were described as students who studied and moved about most of the time in almost total isolation from our 2,000 white classmates, because the whites who once tried to befriend us had been intimidated either by social ostracism or by threats. Reading the article made me shudder, but it also helped me know we weren't imagining things. It was indeed getting more and more difficult to survive inside Central. We now had it confirmed from the most reliable source, hardcore segregationists themselves. And as far as I could tell, there was absolutely nothing we could do about it. On Monday, November 25th, I prepared myself to speak to 250 students gathered for Central High's early morning chapel service. As I walked toward the front of the room and faced those white students, all staring at me. My knees felt weak, and the back of my neck was tight. I stood at a podium in a room filled with people who didn't relish my speaking to them. Taking a deep breath, I began the talk I had practiced in front of the mirror and in front of Grandma and Mama. The light from the window at the back of the room was my focus. Mother Lois had said never to look any single member of the audience in the eye when you're speaking. At first, I gobbled some of the words, and then, as I remembered Grandma India's advice, I calmed down. She had said, "God speaking, you're merely the instrument he chooses at this time. God is a wonderful speaker, so you have absolutely nothing to be nervous about." I didn't speak about integration or say things about us or them. I just talked about God and how he cares for each of us. At first, I could tell by the students' expressions that they didn't like what I was saying. Some frowned while others contorted their faces to show their contempt. Many had perfectly blank looks, but a few listened intently and nodded their heads in agreement. Afterward, two people came up to congratulate me and ask why I had a northern accent and used such correct English. "Northern accent? Did they really ask you about that?" Mother Lois grinned as I described my speaking. You tell them your mama's an English teacher, and in this house, we speak only the King's English. We were discussing my day, sitting in our robes at the dining room table, after dinner and baths, playing Monopoly. The house was festive, and we were surrounded by the aroma of mincemeat and sweet potato pies cooking in the oven. Any flying objects? Actually, some of them were very nice. You were right, Grandma. She didn't look up. She was preoccupied with examining her next move on the board. We were already resigned to the fact that she would skunk us all once again. Right? How so? She mumbled, not taking her attention off the game for even one instant. Well, for just that moment, I felt we had something in common, our love of the Lord. I think they felt it, too, because some of them smiled and spoke to me. Some day they'll have the courage to be nice to you, outside that room of worship. I don't think so, Grandma, because they would have to take so much criticism from their friends and families. This year is different. It won't always be this way. She rolled the dice, bought the last available property, and once again, we'd all been trounced by our sweet grandma, the Monopoly champ. When Mrs. Bates telephoned to say the nine of us would be gathering for an official Thanksgiving dinner to be held at her house Tuesday evening, before the holiday, she mentioned that there would be a news conference. I cringed at the thought. Whenever there was special press coverage on us, the abuse we later suffered at Central was in direct proportion to the size and quality of the story printed or aired. When Mother and I arrived at Mrs. Bates' home for the Thanksgiving dinner, I knew even more people than usual were there because we couldn't find a place to park. When I entered the spacious living room, there was standing room only. I had never seen so many people, most of them reporters, squeezed into that space under hot, glaring lights. At the center of the room, some of the other nine students, dressed in Sunday best, were sitting at a table set with the same care Grandma used on holidays, linen and lace and silver, and a beautifully prepared bird. Mrs. Bates directed me to a seat, and I squeezed past Jeff and Gloria to get to my place. Even more reporters with more cameras and equipment packed into the room as we tried to give the impression of having a normal meal. Some of the others were reviewing speeches they had prepared. I hadn't prepared anything, because by now, the art of giving an interview was second nature, or at least that's what I thought. Once the cameras were rolling and the microphones recording, the questions began to fly. When Mrs. Bates asked, "Do you kids want white meat or dark meat?" I spoke without thinking. "This is an integrated turkey." The annoyed expression on her face matched the one on Mother's, letting me know that maybe I should have prepared a speech. The reporters began snickering as they posed a series of questions on turkeys and integration, calling on me by name to answer. My palms began sweating and my mouth turned dry. I hadn't meant to put my foot in my mouth. I didn't want the others to think I was trying to steal the spotlight, but once I had spoken out of turn, integrated turkey became the theme. "You'll live to regret that statement, Melba," Mother said as we were driving home. I knew she was agonizing over the consequences of my frivolity. She was right. I would suffer. There came a day just before Thanksgiving break when Danny broke the rules again and came close up to talk to me. He wouldn't say whether or not he was leaving for good, but he behaved in a strange way, saying over and over again, "Take care of yourself. You hear me? Don't bend over to pick up any books or walk in dark corners." He winked and smiled as he backed away, giving me a military salute. I stood frozen in my tracks, holding back the tears. Over and over again, I asked him if he were going away for good, but he wouldn't tell me. Just mind your P's and Q's. He turned on his heels. I couldn't admit to myself it was really true. I turned away and ran in the opposite direction, never looking back, never turning to let him see the tears in my eyes. From that moment on, whenever I thought about Danny and the 101st being gone for good, I pushed the idea out of my mind because I couldn't bear to deal with it. I just had to pretend it wasn't so, even though some part of me kept saying I truly had to fend for myself now. My real Thanksgiving at home was a special day of peace and joy. It was wonderful being with all my relatives, and I was able to convince them not to talk about Central High. For just that day, I felt normal, and I hoped that my life could be that way soon. I came face to face with reality later that evening as I read the Gazette headlines. Last of 225 GIs leave school. Arkansas's National Guard in charge. The article said the 101st troops had left the day before. Thanksgiving night, I wrote in my diary, Danny and the others have truly gone. He didn't even say goodbye. I will always remember this man. How could I forget his name? I will never know if he only behaved that kindly because he was a great soldier or a good person or both. It doesn't matter. He was wonderful. I want to remember the names of the other nice 101st soldiers as well. Jody, Marty, Mex, and Goggles. I wish Danny had told me he was leaving forever. Although I don't know how I could have thanked him in words, I might have cried, and he wouldn't have liked that. I never thought I would have tears in my eyes over some white man. I don't think I'll ever see him again. Thank you, Danny. On Friday, November 29th, the Gazette headline brought more bad news, especially for Minnie Jean. Mothers League head protests Negroes Part and CHS Talent Program. The Mothers League of Central High School has issued a protest on behalf of their organization against a Negro girl's participation in a talent program sponsored by Central High School. The article went on to name Minnie Jean Brown specifically and to say that we should not be allowed to participate in any extracurricular activities. That night, Grandmother added to my worry list, President Eisenhower's had a slight stroke, she said. We gotta pray for him quick. I knew the president was important in my life. If things got rough inside Central, I needed him to be alive and well so he could send the troops back. Mother said we should send him a telegram of hope and prayer, and so we did. I spent much of the day agonizing over how much worse things could get on Monday, what with the papers printing my integrated turkey line and announcing the final departure of the 101st. 19. Nine Negroes begin 12th week at CHS with no incidents. Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, December 3rd, 1957. We wondered how the Gazette editors had come to that conclusion since they didn't have anyone inside the school to see us being kicked or inked or spat upon or scalded in the showers. They were like so many of the adults around us, content to pretend for the moment that all was well as we began classes at Central High on December 2nd. But we knew better. Our day-to-day experience showed us that the situation was worsening. On that day, Minnie Jean, Thelma, and I rode in a carpool to school. Once again, Minnie Jean talked enthusiastically about her hopes of appearing on stage in yet another Central High program. Sometimes her enthusiasm even sparked a flickering hope in me that we could be included in the holiday festivities springing up all around us. We heard only bits and pieces of what was going on, but still it all seemed to be so much bigger and more exciting than anything we'd seen at our old school. At Central, there was money for costumed plays and lavish stage productions and parties in fancy hotels. They were doing all the things I'd seen in magazines or on television. When, on a rare occasion, someone ventured to explain to us what was going on, students nearby would draw them aside and chastise them. I felt like a child peeking in the window of the candy store. I hungered for more details of the activities I was excluded from. I put together snippets of conversation as one does a puzzle, anxious to see the final picture. I would forever have an empty spot in my heart when I thought about Christmas of my junior year. We nine had been very active in our former school. Choral groups, honor society activities, scouts, sports, and especially Christmas pageants. I felt the loss of that participation deeply, and I could tell the others did as well. And now, we weren't even invited to holiday parties with our old school friends. Some of them feared for their safety when we were around. Others didn't agree with what we were doing and refused to have anything to do with us. Still, others didn't mean us any harm. It was a case of out of sight, out of mind. I consoled myself by believing it was probably for the best that I was so preoccupied with staying alive at Central. That meant I didn't have as much time to think about how lonely I was. When I heard Minnie Jean talking about joining in, I wished her well, but underneath it all, I knew she had gotten her hopes up too high. She was being targeted because of her persistence, and thanks to my Thanksgiving comment, so was I.
Do all niggas eat integrated turkeys?
One boy shouted, putting his foot out to trip me in the hallway on the way to my first class.
Oops, I said, as I stepped on his foot hard.
Oh, excuse me, I grinned. His face reddened. The subject of the turkey was brought up many more times by the end of the day, and not in a friendly fashion. The only thing that kept me going was counting the days until Christmas vacation. I could see that surviving was wearing us all down. Thelma, who had always managed her heart defect, was forced to rest much more often, squatting down close to the floor, her head bowed to catch her breath. Ernie wasn't smiling quite as much. He was getting a wrinkle line in his forehead. I teased him about being our senior member and showing his age. Carlotta had slowed down. All along, the 101st had called her the Roadrunner or Speedy, and her agility had sometimes protected her from would-be attackers. Now, she was a bit jumpy and no longer spoke of wanting to join the athletic events at Central. Minnie Jean was visibly agitated and jittery, heartbroken that she would not be included in any performances, and feeling more and more trapped by the edict that no matter what was said or done to us, we could not retaliate. Terry seemed jaded and speculated about whether or not we would last the year. Gloria and Elizabeth were quiet and pensive like Jeff. Each one of us talked of how much we looked forward to the upcoming 2 weeks of Christmas vacation, when we could stay home and recharge our batteries. And in our weakest moments, when we stood with physical wounds or bruises to our spirits, there was even talk that the Christmas break might be an opportunity to let go of our dream and choose another school. As I entered Central a few days before my December 7th birthday, I suspected that the glaring headlines in the Arkansas Democrat the previous evening would be flaunted in our faces. The report said the troops that guarded us had cost taxpayers $3.4 million. Needless to say, we had that figure pushed in our faces over and over before the day was done. But the Gazette headlines told the story that gave real cause for alarm that day. Judge resets trial on NAACP leader. The vice president of the North Little Rock chapter of the NAACP was being charged with not making records available. Mrs. Bates fined $100 by Robinson.
The state president of the NAACP was fined $100 yesterday in Little Rock Municipal Court for failure to supply information on the NAACP requested by the city under a new ordinance. Bennett notices served on NAACP. Three more officers of the NAACP have been served notices to supply information to the city under the Bennett ordinance. City officials continue to harass the NAACP leaders just as the students were harassing us at school. My days inside Central were now graded by the severity of the pain I endured. Two huge boys with flat tops and sideburns had begun a full-time mission of making my days miserable. Each morning they stood in front of my homeroom door to greet me first thing.
"Good morning, nigga. Aren't you all gonna talk some of that coon jab you speak?"
I mustered the coldest glare I could manage, determined not to show how much they really frightened me. They followed me from class to class, walking up close, stomping my heels and littering my trail with flying objects, punches, and degrading catcalls. By the fifth day, I was getting rattled, but I knew I had to endure with grace because nothing could make them go away except a fair-minded teacher who witnessed their antics and took action on my behalf. I had little hope of that happening. By the tenth day, their nonstop torture made me feel as if I were losing my mind. I had to keep telling myself what Grandma said. I couldn't ever lose my mind because God is my mind. Still, I imagine I had one of those machine guns television gangsters use. I would fire round after round over their heads to frighten the living daylights out of them. I shook my head to clear my thoughts. I would have to do more prayer for them and for me. I knew guns were forbidden, even in my thoughts. At the same time, I dreaded my English teacher's choice for a book report assignment, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. She had assigned one of the most radical segregationists to present his report in front of the class. In an annoyingly loud voice, he repeated the words, "Nigger Jim," at least 17 times. After each time, he paused to eyeball me with a devilish grin and wait for the reaction of other snickering students. At the end of his report, he curtsied to applause. I was overcome with the thought of my hands around his throat, squeezing tight. To stave off the anger bubbling inside me, I wrote the 23rd Psalm as fast as I could. Just as I was asking God to forgive me for so despising any of his children, one of the boys passed my seat and kicked my ankle. I had to bite my lip to keep from crying aloud at the pain. My ankle was swelling fast. I waited until everyone left the classroom before I tried to walk. Limping as best I could, I struggled to get up the stairs to my next class. I couldn't be late for fear of getting a tardy slip. We were well aware that school officials were waiting for any excuse to kick us out. That point was hammered home to us during meetings with the NAACP. Repeatedly, we were told, "Don't give anyone the slightest opportunity to accuse you of being out of line. Don't be late. Don't talk back. Watch your decorum. Watch your grades. Complain only when something is injurious to your health or life-threatening." All the while, a deep yearning for human contact was growing inside me. I had nobody to talk to from 8:20 each morning when I said goodbye to my friends until the bell rang for lunch. I longed for all my old school friends, for the laughter and conversations we had had about the latest fashions, songs on the hit parade, or newspaper headlines. I imagined how it would feel to say hello to the white students and to have them answer with kind words. I longed to say, "Hello, how are you? I like your blouse. What's going on with you?" I longed for someone to acknowledge that I was alive by saying something pleasant to me and allowing me to say something back. It was frustrating to have people so close, have them chatting to each other while saying absolutely nothing to me and never even looking me in the eye. Occasionally, students stood or sat close enough to touch, talking over and around me as though I didn't exist. It was a very painful insult I didn't know how to combat. They were treating me as if I were invisible. Sometimes when a classmate said something funny, I would smile and even laugh out loud, forgetful for just one instant of my predicament. "We weren't talking to you, nigger," they would say. Jolted back to reality by their cruelty, I would catch myself, neutralize my expression to hide my feelings, and stare straight ahead. "Nigger," I would whisper to remind myself. That's all I am to them. They don't see me as a real person. There even came a moment when I pinched myself to see if I was really there. So many times I wanted to shout, "I'm Melba! Don't you see me? I play the piano, I can make blouses, I can write poems, and I sing!" When I felt I couldn't hold it in anymore, I talked to Grandma India. "So, you say you feel neglected because the white folks are ignoring you?" "Yes, ma'am, I really do." I took a seat at the kitchen table. "Let me heat up that milk for you. It's a mite chilly in here." Grandma smiled and stroked my hand as she took the cup and walked over to the stove. She remained silent, as though she were rearranging her words just for me, while she turned to put jelly bean eyes onto the faces of the freshly baked gingerbread men in the pan, resting on top of the counter. And then she turned to look me in the eye as she said, "Did you count on those central people for your spiritual food before you went there?"
"Well, no, ma'am, but..."
"Have you been waiting on them to treat you good and tell you you're all right so you'll know you're all right?"
She had me. When she explained it, it didn't sound the same as when I felt it.
"Does God know your value?"
"Yes, ma'am, he does. But I'm lonely for humans."
"You can never, in this lifetime, count on another human being to keep you from being lonely. Nobody can provide your spiritual food. Not your mama, not your grandma, not your brother, not your 101st gods, not your boyfriend, and certainly not your husband."
"It's so hard sometimes. I don't know if I can make it."
"Patience is a virtue, my child."
I felt my teeth grind and my jaw tighten as anger welled up inside me. Grandma read my thoughts as she always had.
"Anger brings defeat," she told me. "If you fight back, you have a battle, and you will be the loser."
Grandma walked over to take the second pan of gingerbread men from the oven. I thought about how anxious I had been over the past few days, anxious to get the whole thing over with, anxious for revenge against the two boys who had been harassing me. I had even imagined threatening them with a gun. Grandma's answer had not quelled my anger.
"Fighting back is never the solution," she continued.
"But I'm so angry. I'm afraid it's going to swell up and explode."
"Not likely."
She turned to give me her full attention.
"I want you to read about Gandhi," she said, walking closer to me and touching my cheek with her hand. "You read slow and take it all in. You think about all he accomplished without violence or anger."
"Gandhi,
Yes, ma'am. I knew about Gandhi, about his courage even in the face of people beating up on him and calling him ugly names. I didn't think I was that strong and pure.
Those segregationists are counting on you to fail. Go ahead. Hit back. Make them happy.
Your grandmother is right, Mother Lois said as she entered the kitchen and threw her jacket over the chair. You hit back every day you get through. You kick them every week you get through. And if you make it through the year, you've hit them with the biggest blow of all.
20. Sweet 16. How could I be turning sweet 16 in just a few days and be a student at Central High, I thought, as I entered the side door of the school. Looking around, I wanted to take care that no one would bang me on my head or trip me up. I had relished so many dreams of how sweet my 16th year would be, and now it had arrived, but I was here, in this place. As I walked deeper into the dim passageway, I thought about how I had always hoped that my 16th birthday would be second only to my wedding day as the most perfect moment of my life. I had planned every detail of the celebration, beginning at school with my friends, a party at home with a new dress, red and white balloons all over the house, and 16 candles playing on the hi-fi. All my friends would arrive, and I would have my first real date and my first kiss. 16 had always seemed the magic age that signaled the beginning of freedom, when Mama and Grandma might let loose their hold and let me go out with my friends on pre-dates. But with the integration, I was nowhere near being free. And in the midst of everything else, I'd almost forgotten my own birthday. I hadn't even begun preparations. 16 was also going to be my debut year. I had planned to launch my campaign to become a popular girl about school. I would run for student council president, maybe. I would perform on stage, sing the songs of Dinah Washington in school talent shows. Maybe they'd like my singing so much that I'd get a recording contract and be able to help Mama and Grandma so they wouldn't have to work so hard. None of that was going to happen now. Nobody would let me even say good morning at Central, let alone sing on stage.
Hey, nigger, you here again?
A boy's voice pulled me from my thoughts. A strong hand grabbed my wrist and doubled my arm up behind my back, like a policeman arresting a criminal. Frantically, I looked for a teacher or guard. There was none.
Hey, we got us a nigger to play with,
he was shouting to his friends. Soon I'd have several of them on me. I struggled against him, but it was no use. Then I remembered I'd always been told, if a fellow's got so little manhood he'd hit a woman, it's up to that woman to relieve him of what few morsels of his masculinity remain. I bent my knee and jammed my foot backward up his crotch.
Damn you, bitch!
He shouted.
You'll be a dead nigger before this day is over.
Grabbing my purse, I raced down the hall, leaving my textbooks behind. I felt the power of having defended myself. I walked up the stairs to homeroom, only to be greeted by the same two boys who had been taunting me every day. I squared my shoulders and glared at them as I whispered, I will be here tomorrow, and the next day, and the next. The Nine Who Dared, New York Post, Thursday, December 5th, 1957. Newspapers across the country started carrying a series of articles and profiles on the nine of us. Central High segregationists used the details to taunt us. The articles gave specific information on what our homes were like, our backgrounds, our hobbies, our aspirations, all there was to know about us. I began to regret that exposure. Students didn't let up for 1 minute, chirping on about my folks, my mother's teaching, and things I considered personal and sacred. When the 9 of us got together to compare notes, we discovered we were all facing an increasing barrage of injurious activities. What was noticeably different was the frequency and the organized pattern of harassment. Teams of students appeared to be assigned specific kinds of torture. One team concentrated on slamming us into lockers, while another focused on tripping us up or shoving us down staircases. Still, another concentrated on attacks with weapons. Another group must have been told to practice insidious harassment inside the classrooms. Still, others worked at entrapment, luring the boys in dark corners or the girls into tight spots in isolated passageways. Some continued to use the showers as a means of abuse. At the same time, I was feeling alarmed about rumors of segregationist training programs to sharpen the skills of hooligans inside school. I was also increasingly worried about Minnie Jean. She was waging yet another battle with school officials to get permission to appear with the choral group in the Christmas program. No matter how much Thelma and I tried to convince her to let go of the idea, she wouldn't give up the notion that if she could perform, somehow the white students would see she was talented and therefore accept her. Perhaps because of that determination, Minnie Jean was receiving more than her share of daily name-calling, kicking, and hitting, but she was suffering in yet another way. She somehow had more faith than we did in school officials. She continued to count on them to respond with compassion to her reports of being mistreated. It was as though she couldn't believe what she was seeing, so she had to test them to be certain they were really as inhumane as they seemed. The pressure she felt was sapping all her energy. She had also allowed herself to be suckered into the game I called herky-jerky, or now I speak to you, now I don't. Occasionally, really vicious students would make overtures to us. They would smile or say hello for a few days in a row, pretending they had had a change of heart and were now our dearest friends. Just as we were growing to trust them, anxious for the connection, they would ignore us or make us the object of ridicule amid a group of their friends. Sometimes their overtures were intended to make us trust them so they could lead us into traps where we'd be physically abused. But most often, it was for the sheer pleasure of watching the pain we endured when they harshly rejected us. When one girl pretended to befriend Minnie Jean, only to betray her a short time later, Minnie Jean was crushed. She cried in front of school officials. That's when I knew she must be on the edge, because it wasn't like her to show her vulnerability in front of white people. With each passing day, I watched as she grew more fragile. I fretted about Minnie Jean as I plunged into my birthday party plans, but the more I tried to console her, the less she listened. She was the only one of my 8 central friends I had invited to my party, because I wanted to escape all thoughts of being an integration person. I made her promise not to talk about Central in front of our Horace Mann friends. Not inviting the others made me feel guilty. But had the 8 come, I knew I would have been separate, one of the Little Rock 9, and not just plain Melba, a member of my old group. I counted on reconnecting to my friends from my former school. I wanted them to accept me, to take me back into their fold. I had personally called or left messages with the parents of all the people on my guest list. On the morning of my birthday, Saturday, I felt relieved when Minnie Jean called to say she couldn't come after all because she had a family event that day. Maybe with only me there, I could fade into the group and just this once be one of them. Vince was the first to arrive, looking a little ill at ease.
"Good evening, birthday girl,"
he said, handing me a small box with a bow. I hadn't seen him in a while. I'd almost forgotten how light-skinned he was. With his dark, shiny hair piled high and his sideburns, he resembled those sideburners at Central.
"Thanks. I'm glad you came," I said, as my mind worked hard to separate the way he looked from the images of the boys who treated me so badly at Central.
"Vince is one of my people, no matter how white he looks," I told myself. I tried to think about the first date we had and to focus on how much I had liked being with him.
"Long time no see," Vince said as I led him into the living room. "You never return my calls."
He was right. Somehow the whole integration thing had even dulled my desire for daydreams about him. He had become lost in the shuffle, an afterthought, but I couldn't tell him that.
"I think about you," I told him, "especially when Grandma goes to the wrestling matches. I wanted to call."
He nodded his head, but he didn't look like he believed me. As we continued polite but strained talk, I kept my eyes on the clock. I unwrapped his gift, squealing with delight at the tiny gold hoop earrings. Mama and Grandma made several trips to bring food in, then take it out for warming, then bring it back. After an hour when no other guests had arrived, Conrad insisted we begin eating. The explanation came when my old friend Marcia phoned to say she wouldn't be coming, but she'd drop off my birthday present the next day. I had counted on Marcia's coming. She was kind of the leader of the group. If she didn't come, I worried that nobody else would either. Then she confirmed my worst fears. She explained that another friend, Anne, was giving her annual Christmas party, and most of the people I invited would be going there. But I knew that wouldn't begin before 8. When I asked why they couldn't stop by beforehand, there was a long silence, and then she said, "Melba, the truth is we're all afraid to come to your house."
"Afraid?"
I mumbled nervously.
"Sure. Some of us get those same calls you get from those crazy white people saying they're gonna bomb your house. One of you all already got bombed. What's her name? Carlotta had a bomb under her porch. And that Mrs. Bates, she's had several. What's to keep them from bombing your house tonight while we're all there?"
"Why didn't you say so earlier when I called?"
"I didn't want to hurt your feelings. You got to get used to the fact that you all are just not one of us anymore. You stuck your necks out, but we're not willing to die with you."
"Marcia, I thought you were my friend." I heard my voice get loud as anger rose in me.
"At least you could have told me there was another party going on."
I shouted into the receiver, slamming it down. My feelings were doubly hurt. No one bothered to tell me to move my party to another date, and worse yet, they were having the biggest Christmas party of the season without inviting me. Even though I felt so embarrassed I could die, I kept smiling, trying to pretend to Vince that I wasn't brokenhearted about the empty room we sat in with all those balloons on the ceiling and all that food getting cold on the dining room table.
"Let's turn on the TV now, since nobody's coming. That just means more food for us."
Conrad's voice sounded like he was speaking through a booming microphone as he burst into the room. I felt myself cringe as I watched Vince's face turn red.
"Shush your mouth, boy, and get back into that kitchen."
Grandma was trying her best not to look disappointed, but I could see she felt sad for me. I moved toward the dining room and started taking things to the kitchen. I caught Grandma unaware. I could see there was moisture in her eyes.
"Don't worry about the party, Grandma. It doesn't matter," I said, touching her shoulder.
"You
just sit yourself down and entertain that young man. He doesn't want to be entertained. He wants to go to Anne's Christmas party where everybody is. He's asked me to go with him. I was hoping that since it was my birthday, they would make an exception and allow me to go with Vince.
How can we allow you to go out that way? In public? Don't you see those two white devils parked in their car across the street? Mutt and Jeff are just waiting for us to make a mistake so they can hang you. We couldn't rest easy with you out at night that way.
Even on my birthday? Especially on your birthday. This day reminds us of how important you are to us. Now, you invite Vince to sit a while. We'll have a nice evening playing games and all.
But Vince clearly wanted to move on to Anne's party. He had promised he would go, and he wanted to be with our friends. Only they weren't our friends anymore. They were his. I saw him to the door and stood in the doorway, looking at Mutt and Jeff's car parked beneath the streetlight. Grandma was right. It wasn't safe. The integration had stolen my 16th birthday. Later that night, before I sobbed into my pillow, I wrote, "Please, God, let me learn how to stop being a warrior. Sometimes I just need to be a girl."
Step up in rumors, incidents, complaints noted at school. Arkansas Gazette, Saturday, December 14, 1957. Army to cut guard force at Central High School by 432 men. Arkansas Gazette, Saturday, December 14, 1957. With 4 days to go before the Christmas holidays, we were very aware of a last-minute drive to get us out of school before the new year. Flyers and cards appeared saying, 2, 4, 6, 8, we ain't gonna integrate. No, not in 58. There was lots of talk about how we wouldn't come back when the new semester started. Meanwhile, Minnie Jean continued to bang her head against that stone wall, trying to get permission to participate in the Christmas activities. She could not explain why, but it was as though she were driven. When Principal Matthews once again turned down her request to sing with the Glee Club in the Christmas show, she balked. Her mother requested a meeting with Assistant Principals Powell and Huckabee, along with Principal Matthews and Mrs. Bates. Even after that confrontation, they turned her down, but she refused to take no for an answer. Students used all the flack over Minnie Jean's persistence as another reason to taunt us and to escalate their campaign against us. She had shown herself vulnerable by displaying her temper and her pain and by letting them know how badly she wanted to participate. That was all they needed. They worked hard at getting her to blow her fuse. By that time, we were all suffering from extreme fatigue as we marked our calendars and counted down the moments before the blissful 2 weeks of Christmas vacation. Most of all, I looked forward to feeling safe, to having fun with maybe a party or two, and lots of lounging in front of the television. That was my plan. Grandma had already begun shopping, hiding gifts, and testing the Christmas lights so she could replace burnt-out bulbs. She had also begun making dough for Christmas cookies and placing it in the freezer. Mother Lois was eyeballing trees, so we'd choose the perfectly shaped one. On Tuesday, December 17th, when we had one more day to go before vacation, 5 of us entered the cafeteria. Lunchtime was always a hazard, and recently even more so. I had been avoiding the cafeteria, eating my sandwich alone in any safe place I could find. The cafeteria was such a huge place, with so many of our attackers gathered at one time. There were no official-looking adults or uniformed Arkansas National Guardsmen inside the cafeteria.
Without fail, we knew we could expect some form of harassment. As always, on Tuesday, the hot lunch was chili, which Minnie Jean loved. So while I took my seat with the others, she went to get in line to buy her chili. Ernie emerged from the line ahead of her and sat down at our table. As Minnie Jean made her way back toward us, her tray loaded down with a big bowl of chili, we saw her hesitate. She had to inch her way through a tight spot where mostly boys sat at tables on either side of her path. She had stopped dead in her tracks. We all froze, realizing she must be in real trouble. We could see two boys near her, one directly in her path. Something awful was happening, but there was no way any of us could do anything to rescue her. We had been instructed that in such instances, we were never to move toward the person in danger for fear of starting a riot. I was panic-stricken. Minnie Jean was being hassled by those boys. Snickering among themselves and taunting her, they had pushed a chair directly in front of her. For a long moment, she stood there patiently, holding her tray high above their heads. It was all I could do to hold on to my chair and not go to help her. Like a broken record, the words played over and over in my head. Intervening on her behalf would blur the lines between who was the victim and who was the person at fault. If other white students joined the melee to rescue the other side, we'd have a brawl. They outnumbered us at least 200-1. Still, I wanted to go to her, move the chair, take her tray, tell her to back up and go another way, do something, anything. As more and more people realized something was brewing, the chatter in the cafeteria quieted down. I could tell Minnie Jean was trapped and desperate and very fast running out of patience. She was talking back to the boys in a loud voice, and there was jostling all around her. Frantically, I looked around to see if there were any adults nearby who could be trusted to help. We had come to believe that the vice principal for girls, Mrs. Huckabee, made some efforts to be fair during these situations, but she was nowhere in sight. I beckoned to Minnie Jean to go around her hasslers, but she was standing perfectly still. It was as though she were in a trance, fighting within herself. Later, she would explain that the boys had been taunting her, sticking their feet in the aisle to trip her, kicking her and calling her names. But we were not close enough to see details of the dilemma she faced. All we saw was her wavering as though she were trying to balance herself. And then her tray went flying, spilling chili all over two of the boys. Everyone was stunned, silent for a long moment. Her attackers sat with astonished looks on their faces as greasy chili dripped down over their heads. All at once, our people who were serving food behind the counter began to applaud. This was greeted by an ominous silence and then loud voices, all chattering at once as the chili-covered boys stood up. I wondered whether we'd ever get out of there alive. Suddenly, a school official showed up, and Minnie Jean was whisked away while we were hustled out of the cafeteria. Word got around school immediately. I could tell there was an undercurrent of unrest among the student body. More clusters of people gathered along the hallway chanting, 2, 4, 6, 8, we ain't gonna integrate. Some were applauding and laughing. I wondered why some students were jubilant, almost celebrating. I especially noticed that some of the segregationist leaders seemed very pleased with themselves. As I went to my afternoon classes, I couldn't help being very anxious about what was happening to Minnie Jean that caused such a jovial uproar. "Looking for your little nigger friend," one of the students said as I walked down the stairs to study hall. "She's done got herself suspended.
She can only get back in if the superintendent lets her, and you know what that means.
One nigger down and eight to go, was the cry we heard as we left Central High for Christmas vacation. I could hear those declarations.